7 minutes before 8 a.m. You're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka. I'm Peter Apathy, and this is Raven News. A jury has convicted a man of second-degree murder in a 1996 shooting death in Yakutat. Montana resident Robert Kowalski was convicted only on some of the charges brought against him. Now prosecutors are considering a retrial. Matt Miller reports.
A partial verdict was announced Friday afternoon by a Juno jury in the Robert Kowalski homicide case.
Count two. We, the jury, find the defendant, Robert D. Kowalski, guilty of murder in the second degree as charged in count two of the indictment.
Thank you.
As for conduct with extreme indifference to human life. After nearly two full days of deliberations that followed 3.5 weeks of witness testimony and evidence presentation, jurors were unable to reach agreement on a separate charge of first-degree murder. This is Judge Luis Menendez.
I believe a manifest necessity has been established to declare a mistrial in that matter, and the manifest necessity exists. In fact, there's no probability that a unanimous verdict can be reached as to count one.
Prosecutors originally declined to charge Kowalski for the July 1996 death of girlfriend Sandra Perry at the Glacier Bear Lodge in Yakutat. He claimed the shotgun fired when he was startled by Perry or when he tripped over an obstacle and fell on the bed where Perry was lying. Alaska investigators re-examined the Yakutat case after Kowalski was convicted of killing Lorraine K. Marin in March of 2008 near Kalispell, Montana. In September of 2011, he was indicted by a Juneau grand jury on first- and second-degree murder charges in the Perry case. Jurors sent out a series of notes Friday morning that signaled their inability to reach agreement on at least one of the charges. They then asked to hear a recording of testimony by a lodge guest who had been sleeping in a room next door when Perry was killed. About an hour after the playback, the jury sent out another note expressing their inability to reach a verdict on the first-degree murder charge. The three women and nine men were called back into the courtroom, quizzed about the deadlock, and then Judge Menendez asked them to return to the deliberation room and fill out a verdict form. Judge Menendez set a status hearing for April 17th in which state prosecutors may announce their intentions for a possible retrial. A sentencing date for Kowalski's conviction on second-degree murder will not be set until issues stemming from the mistrial can be resolved. One of Perry's sons, who testified during the trial, listened to the return of the verdict by telephone, and his quick comment briefly stopped excused jurors in their tracks as they filed out of the courtroom.
Your Honor?
Yes.
May I speak, please?
Mr. Padgett.
This is Jeremy Padgett.
Mr. Padgett, is it necessary, sir?
I just wanted to say thank you. That's it.
Okay. Be well, Mr. Padgett. Thank you, everybody.
One juror said afterward that they simply could not agree on any possible intent as they considered the first count of first-degree murder. There was also no evidence presented by the prosecution regarding the exact path of the shotgun slug, which could have revealed more clues about the nature of the shooting. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Inter-Island Ferry Authority General Manager Dennis Watson took the ferry to Ketchikan this week to give an update to the Chamber of Commerce. KRBD's Layla Carey was there and has this report.
The Inter-Island Ferry Authority carries about 50,000 passengers each year between Prince of Wales Island and Ketchikan. And a recent study by Scheinberg Associates shows that over 12 years, the ferry saved those people more than $14 million. That is, if the same number of people had traveled by plane. Those are just a couple of the benefits both islands have experienced since the IFA started service in 2002. Watson talked a little about the study, but he quickly opened the floor for questions. One audience member asked about the IFA's spare ferry. The IFA owns the Stikine and the Prince of Wales. The latter is the Port Authority's standby boat, so most of the time it's not in use. Watson says they looked into selling the Prince of Wales, but it's a challenging decision.
It's a tough one. It cost us roughly $350,000 a year to babysit that boat. But I can give you a good for instance. A couple of years ago, we were just getting by Guard Island, and the Stikine swallowed two valves. So back to town we limped. And 3 weeks later, we were in operation and got the boat back and going. Had we not had it, we wouldn't have had service for those 3 weeks.
Watson says that with a couple of other mechanical issues that came up that same year, the Stikine was out of service for about 6 weeks. On top of emergencies, there's also routine maintenance to schedule. A break in service affects more than just passengers. The IFA transports about 3 million pounds of seafood annually, supporting the commercial fishing industry. It also carries fresh produce from Ketchikan to POW, providing faster service than a weekly barge.
There are an awful lot of businesses and activities that depend on that boat running back and forth. So it not only is the issue with the expense to us for keeping the lay-by boat, but it's what happens to other people if we don't have it.
In response to another audience question, Watson says that nearly all of the IFA's approximately 40 employees live on Prince of Wales Island, and the onboard employees work 12-hour shifts 4 days a week. He says 12 hours is the limit allowed by the U.S. Coast Guard, and they push it to that limit in order to maximize port time in Ketchikan.
I mean, it seemed nice to come over here and just turn right around and go back. That isn't the way it works for the people that want to come over here and say, do a doctor appointment and then go back that day, which is one of the huge savings that's involved with it right now, because a tremendous amount of the medical care that is provided to people on the island happens in Ketchikan.
The IFA leaves Hollis on Prince of Wales at 8 in the morning. The trip takes about 3 hours, so passengers have about 4 hours in Ketchikan before the ferry departs at 3:30 p.m., headed back to the Big Island. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
More details from the Scheinberg Associates study of the IFA's impact on Prince of Wales Island and Ketchikan are available through a link with this report on our website, kcaw.org. Graduation time is just around the corner, and for most seniors, that means walking a stage and accepting a diploma. But a few students a year in Petersburg do not receive a diploma because they didn't pass a test. A bill making its way through the Alaska legislature would change that. House Bill 220 would repeal the high school graduation qualifying exam. Angela Denning stopped into the Petersburg High School last week during test-taking time and has this story.
The high school is especially quiet. Red signs are posted on the outside of the library doors and several classrooms.
And so you can see we have big red signs, testing do not disturb.
High school principal Rick Dormer says large groups of 10th graders are getting tested in the classrooms, and smaller groups are in the library. The signs help others know to stay out, because a quiet environment is important.
We're in the middle of it here today, and kids are in a room, and it's 3 hours, and it's, you know, make it or break it. And we have had kids really crying before the test, crying after the test. It's high stress, it's high stakes.
There's a lot riding on this test, and students feel the pressure. If they don't pass it, they don't graduate with a diploma.
And they must pass in three areas, reading, writing, and mathematics, and they must pass it with a certain score that's set by the state to earn their diploma. So despite what anything that a student may or may not do, if they complete all graduation requirements, which has happened here in Petersburg, and do not pass this particular exam in the state of Alaska, we cannot give them a diploma from Petersburg High School. Rather, they get what we call certificate of completion that is not equivalent.
The certificate does not hold the same weight as a diploma. Students who want to further their education after high school can't qualify for financial aid. Sonia Stein is the director of the Student Financial Assistance Office at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The Federal Department of Education requires that a student has a high school diploma or its equivalent in order to be federal financial aid eligible.
An equivalent would be the GED, or the General Education Development, which would require students to pass another test. The exit exam has been required in Alaska for a decade. It was established through state law before the No Child Left Behind law prompted other standardized tests. There's no middle ground with the exit exam. Either you pass it or you don't. Principal Rick Dormer says it can be heartbreaking.
We've had two students who have not passed that test by 1 point. One section by 1 point.
In both cases, the school paid some extra money to appeal the results to the state's education department, but it didn't work.
We don't believe that's the best assessment of a kid's knowledge of what they know. Really, any testing is there just as a measure to see what they know, and then you build on it. And so we don't agree that high-stakes testing is the best measure of what a kid's knowledge is and whether or not they deserve a diploma. I think it's much more complicated than a one-shot test.
House Bill 220 would work retroactively, so past students who received a certificate instead of a diploma because they didn't pass a test would be able to get a diploma. They just have to request it. So far, the bill hasn't seen much opposition. It passed the House with a vote of 32-5. The Parnell administration and the Education Department support getting rid of the test as well. The bill is sponsored by Representative Pete Higgins, a Republican from Fairbanks. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Richard Peterson of Kasan is the new president of the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes in Alaska. He takes over from Ed Thomas, president for 27 of the past 30 years. Peterson has served as a vice president of the organization's executive council. He's also president of the tribal council for the organized village of Kasan on eastern Prince of Wales Island. He was elected and sworn in Friday during the Central Council's tribal assembly in Juneau. The council is Southeast's largest tribal organization. Peterson told delegates he will work with everyone he can.
I don't feel like I'm alone. I know that I have everybody holding me up. I know that I can accomplish what we need because I won't be I, it'll be we.
Delegates chose Peterson over two other candidates, Ozzie Shakely and Harold Houston of Juneau. Another candidate who announced earlier was not on the final ballot. Peterson was elected by an overwhelming majority on the first vote. Central Council elections usually require two or more ballots. The new president was praised by his opponents and his immediate predecessor in the job. Alaska Native Brotherhood Grand Camp President Bill Martin, who also served in the post, agreed.
Richard Peterson has worked hard for this position. He's an honest man and has the highest integrity. And those are the things we look for.
The Tlingit Haida Central Council provides education, housing, financial assistance, foster care, and other programs to tribal members. It began in 1935. And that's all for Raven News. For this hour, you can listen to or read most Raven News stories again on our website, kcaw.org. This is Morning Edition on Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka, where it's 42 degrees under foggy and misty skies.